welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, a Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I'm joined today by Bruegel's Heather Graby and Professor Estelle Cantillon, who studies the nature markets and the effort to put a price on nature, not just on carbon, but on all of the biodiversity and natural resources we have in our world. So thank you all for joining us today. Estelle, can you tell us what your work is about? Like, when we say nature credits, nature shares, nature markets, what are we even talking about?
So we designed a proposal to think about how we scale finance for nature in the global south. Okay, that was kind of the question we were asking ourselves. And we first looked at how it's currently organized, and essentially these are the voluntary carbon market, voluntary nature market. The way this works today is that you've got somebody who manages a project that absorbs carbon, redeploy, redevelop, regenerate nature, and gets credits thanks to these benefits he or she generates.
So is that always from a remediation project, or can it be also for things that you do that destroy carbon or that destroy nature? Like, what's the interaction there?
So you can do things. So it's like to plant trees, that would be regeneration, or it could be avoid destroying land and forest. So it can be both ways. But in any case, so you've got these projects, and today they either avoid problems or they generate benefits, and you get a little credit for this that you can sell in the market. Okay, then somebody can buy this credit and use it to show that they're doing some good stuff. Now, this is very transactional, and tomorrow that person can go to another project and so on and so forth. It has a lot of issues that have been widely documented in the research literature. Some of this is about how do you actually measure these things? Is the baseline correct? For example, is it really additional? So, maybe you've planted trees here, but you've destroyed the forest elsewhere. It's called leakage. I mean, there's a bunch of these things that have been documented. There's been a few scandals where some of these credits have lost value. The point here is that some of these issues are being fixed either through tighter legal rules or standards or certificates. So both from public governance, but also the private actors are doing this, or through technology. Okay. There are two things that all of these efforts will not be able to address. The first one is the fact that nature is fundamentally impermanent. Okay, by this, I mean that, you grow a forest, it absorbs carbon, there can be a drought, there can be a fire that destroys this forest, and the forest will be releasing the carbon, will be all the biodiversity that was existing there will be just collapsing. That's one thing. And so there is no regulation will change what nature is. The second thing is that all of these new rules and new higher standards for deciding what is really additional, to what extent the baseline is correct, and so on, this is increasing transaction costs. Okay, so today our estimate is about 40% of what somebody pays to these projects actually goes in the pockets of the various intermediaries. So it's hard to scale a market where 40% it goes into intermediation costs. So that's kind of where our starting point is. And so our proposal is very different. Instead of thinking about these credits as being transactional, where you generate some benefit, you issue a credit, we're just saying, no, we just need to think about nature as equity. And actually, we talk about natural capital. Capital is equity, okay? And the idea is that now, instead of having buyers, we have investors. They invest in a project, they get shares in that project, and these shares gives them the right to what we call carbon dividends or nature dividends. So it's not about money here. It's about the project is going to generate some benefits, nature benefits, natural benefit. And the dividends are going to be released to say, like, well, this has been absorbing such and such amount of carbon, so it's been generating this and this amount of biodiversity benefits. But what's important, though, and that's where the difference between a share and a credit is, that think about it as a company. A company is making a profit. It doesn't distribute all of this profit into its shareholders as dividends. It's keeping some in case something happens to the company. The idea here is exactly the same. So the project generates some benefits. Imagine, like, you know, 100 tons of carbon, say. It's going to keep maybe, you know, 50. I mean, this will need to be decided on a scientific basis, but, you know, some amount in the project and only release some parts as dividends. So that's really the one, the big part of our proposal is about that, is about, you know, thinking about shares and not credits.
Thank you for explaining that. So now I'd like to ask you to walk us through who the buyers are in both of these examples. And are we looking only at do-gooders like foundations or governments, or are we looking at people who are required by regulation to buy things, or are we looking at people who think they can actually make money off this stuff? Like, how does... Walk us through it for both the credits and the equities that you propose.
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, it's really important. So the way we thought about this is that we don't think do-gooders will be enough to create a demand. Why? Because if you look at the world today, carbon markets and nature markets mandate, like, you know, regulatory compliance carbon markets are expanding. So there's going to be, you know, the space for voluntary action is going to go down over time. And so we thought about the way we're thinking about creating demand is the following. So we've actually leveraged some research by Patrick Bolton, who's done work on science Paris-aligned financial portfolios. So the idea here is when you have a financial portfolio made of obligations and shares, it has a carbon footprint. And you could ask these fund managers, and here we're thinking about pension funds, to reduce their carbon footprint over time in a way that's aligned with the ambition of the Paris Agreement. And it's easy to do it on the carbon side because Patrick has done the work that has shown that you can compute a carbon footprint of a financial portfolio. And actually what he's shown with his co-authors is that forcing funds to be Paris aligned doesn't come with such a high financial penalty. In our case, our shares would be providing an extra opportunity, an extra option, an extra way of reducing the carbon footprint of these funds. So it's even going to be cheaper to do this. Now, conceptually, thinking about nature and the nature footprint of a forest, it's the same thing. The measurement is not as mature, but, you know, there are things as, you know, biodiversity, corporate biodiversity footprint, that's a measure that exists. And you could think about the imposing also a mandate on the pension funds to reduce their biodiversity footprint.
Thanks. Heather, in your work on this, you've focused on the societal change that comes from looking at nature this way, from trying to put nature on a more even footing with money as opposed to a thing that happens in the world that we care about, but that's completely disconnected from this resource use. What do you make of this idea and what's its potential to change how things work?
It's important to think about what kind of price we pay for not having the ecosystem services that nature has provided, which are simply not counted in our methods of measuring what's going on in the economy. GDP, a gross domestic product, is a measure that just ignores how nature provides fresh water, clean air, pollination, and all kinds of other services that are vital not only for agriculture, but also for most economic activity and, of course, for life, including human life. And the problem with those ecosystem services, as they're called, provided by nature, with them not being accounted for, is it's free to destroy them. And the costs of destroying them are not accounted for either. And that means that there's more destruction than there would be if there were some price attached. Now, the idea behind nature credits and nature shares is to pay for either conserving nature, so it's the opportunity cost of not chopping it down in order to plant fields of a monoculture, or not destroying a wetland, which, you know, means that, for example, migrating birds, but also people experiencing a flood don't have the use of that thing that nature has provided. So the idea is that nature credits would provide some kind of income to the owners of that nature, usually the landowner, either to keep the forest or the wetland as it is. So that would be conservation. That's really paying them not to change things, or paying them to restore damage that's been done. So, for example, mangroves are really important to prevent coastal erosion and to keep water clean for fishing. They bring all kinds of benefits, and they routinely get destroyed because people want to build in the place where the mangrove is, or they want to create a port or something like that. So the idea behind restoration of a mangrove is that you pay both for planting the trees and taking care of them. And then you come to the issue about, okay, if you have a one-off transaction where you say, right, I'm going to pay for X amount of mangrove to be planted, that's a one-off credit, which, as Estelle was saying, it's a transaction. And it's hard to prove that it's going to still be there in 10 years' time or in 20 years' time. It's also quite difficult to make sure that the local community is helping to support that mangrove. So the idea, Estelle's and co-author's idea, is you then make it into a share in the mangrove planting and conservation project. So you can have both restoration and conservation over a longer period of time involving the local community. And that's much more likely to make it durable, especially in the global south. That's really key. But I think what we have to remember about these things is ultimately a market requires both supply and demand. And on the supply side, you need credible financial instruments where people can believe that the mangrove really will get planted and it really will get looked after. Okay, so that's where you get into monitoring, reporting, verification, and so on. But on the demand side, philanthropy alone, charitable giving, because it makes us feel great to have mangrove, provides very little money. So just to give you an idea of the amount of money involved, the global biodiversity pledges were that basically this is 196 countries agreed in 2022 on the basis of numerous scientific reports that the world needs about $200 billion every year from governments, companies, and innovative methods like nature credits to finance nature in one way or another. And we need $500 billion in harmful nature-harming subsidies to be eliminated. So $200 billion, $500 billion, total of $700 billion is involved. And the total volume of transactions in nature credits in 2024 was below 1 million. So it's a drop in the ocean, what's available now. And so if you wanted to scale this up, you need to really think very hard about the demand side.
What about the governance? And there's so many ways that we can explore that over the course of this conversation. But I specifically want to ask about the equity idea. If you buy an equity in a company, you may have more or less control over the company, but in theory, you do at least have some sort of shareholder right and shareholder power. Are these completely passive equity things, or do you, by buying in, do you get a vote on something?
The way we think about it is twofold. First, I mean, there's the governance of the project and the governance of the whole scheme. Let's just start with the governance of the project, indeed, where the shareholders are just putting some money and they're just hoping to have these flow of dividends. We are thinking about, you know, the money is actually needed both for at the initial stage of the project when you're restoring nature or planting trees, but also conserving the outcome. It also requires some money. So you can actually free, you know, the money that that is put in and invested can be actually freed over time, depending on the implementation of the land management plan of the project. So that's one way to ensure that the project does what it promised to do. And it's one way to say to avoid any, you know, cheating or moral hazard or people, you know, taking the money and running. So that's that part. So it's not voting. So, for example, we don't think about voting to, you know, one of the things shareholders vote on is how much of the dividend is being distributed. I think here it makes a lot of sense to decide on how much of the dividends are being released based on science and the likelihood that there's going to be a fire in that region or there's going to be a drought in that region. So the exact governance, the rights and responsibilities of the shareholders will need to be a bit different from those of a shareholder in a regular public company, that's for sure.
And how does one get started with this? With credits, we often think about quota, where there's a pre-existing stock of these things, and you either have to get some from the government or you have to buy into the system. Is that the case here, or can a project just, in the same way that a company can say, I'm going to sell stock in myself, they can just make that piece of paper and go raise money with it? Can a project generate this stuff all by themselves, or do they have to somehow get into a quota or an allocation system?
There needs to be you know, a primary market for these shares, and then there's going to be a secondary market. So the primary market, the way we thought about this in the context of scaling up finance for the Global South, is that it's going to be big, you know, think about it as a crowdsourcing markets, like what you have for new companies and so on. So you've got different countries proposing projects, and there's the demand side. It's, again, you know, think about these pension funds mostly, willing to buy shares and at some price. So that would be the primary market. Once these shares are bought at the primary market, we need to think about, you know, what happens next if the pension funds at some points wants to get rid of these shares. So we also thought about a way to make sure that secondary market is liquid enough so that it doesn't destroy value, right? Because if you invest and then you're stuck with your investment, you can be in trouble.
So that's the demand side for buying these things. But on the supply side, can you just make one, or do you need seed money?
Seed money for what?
Well, with carbon credits, for example, as I understand it, you get an allocation from the government for free, or you have to buy some carbon credits and then you can sell them on to someone else. So is there an immediate barrier to entry like that, or...
No, but we think about these projects coming forward, but and actually that's also an important point. Once, you know, that didn't mention so far, which is that so today, a project in the voluntary carbon market can be anyone. So you could tomorrow enter and plant your trees and decide to be certified and sell your credits. Here, we're thinking that it should be at the jurisdiction level rather than at the project level. But the project is at the jurisdiction level. Why? Because it solves a lot of problems. One is that the first one is the size is bigger. Okay. Size bigger means also low, you know, you've got more risk sharing. So it reduces the risk of your asset. You also, it's at the jurisdiction level. So it's also aligned in terms of governance with the local government. And so, which is responsible typically for, you know, the regulations, the enforcement, so on. So I think there's a greater alignment there and also more guarantee that, you know, it's going to be done and carried out. And so we're thinking about this jurisdiction there. And then beyond that, there's no barriers to entry. So a jurisdiction could say, look, we have mangrove. We want to restore mangrove over our entire territory. Here's our restoration plan. Here's our conservation plan. And we need this amount of money to do it.
Thanks for that. In the next part of our podcast, we're going to talk more about financial markets and how they interact with this sort of concept. Heather, I want to ask you, how much of nature finance and sustainable finance in general revolves around an optimistic storyline? And I'll give you one example. In the carbon credits example, there's research out there that suggests that if you are a high carbon emitting industry, that people will require more financial return to invest in you. And one way of interpreting that is to say, look, this is risky because it's bad for the planet. So if you want the money, we need more money back. But the flip side of that is to say that people can make more money when they ignore carbon use because the carbon producers are making more money. So how do we reconcile those differing interpretations, and how do we have a sustainable finance environment that has finance in it?
In financial markets, prices reflect expectations. They reflect what the community of actors in that financial market think that asset is going to be worth in a certain period of time. That's typically how it works. And with shares in companies, there was for a while an assumption that, for example, fossil fuel companies were going to lose value fast because they basically regulation, governments would not be allowing them to continue to make such profits selling oil and gas because the carbon emissions associated with that oil and gas would be priced. Now, that assumption had rather a shock in 2025 because of the change in US policy in particular. But actually, carbon pricing is still happening in a lot of places in the world, notably in Europe, but also other parts of the world. Carbon markets are developing. And although it's still entirely possible to make money out of selling oil and gas, no question about that, over time, it is going to reduce. Demand is going down because renewables are being built and because the business case for clean energy is extremely clear, especially for continents like Europe, where we don't have oil and gas of our own. So it's very, very expensive of us for us to remain dependent on it. So prices for carbon intensive activities like fossil fuels, they're going to reflect how soon investors think that activities will be affected either by regulation or indeed by climate impacts themselves. And this is where the nature side of it comes in, because the prices that are set for nature harming activities versus nature positive activities very much reflect whether the nature positive activities actually generate financial returns or not. And often they don't generate much in financial returns because everything that comes from nature is assumed to be free and it's assumed to be there perpetually. It will be forever there. But actually, many of the long-term investors, especially the insurance companies and the pension funds, are getting very worried about the science, which shows that destruction of nature is really raising the risk level very significantly on the assets that they already hold. Especially, for example, if you own land or if you have either shares or other forms of financial assets in companies that depend on ecosystem services. Now, in the case of the Eurozone, nearly three quarters of bank loans are to companies that are highly dependent on at least one ecosystem service. So there would be a very high level of bankruptcies if that ecosystem service were to be withdrawn or to be significantly damaged, if it couldn't be provided. For example, water scarcity or loss of pollination. That would cost a lot of money, and that cost of money would be reflected in the financial market through the companies and economic activity that's dependent on it. So that's really where the expectations are there. Now, what's tricky about what's happened over the past year is that the assessment of transition risks, or the assessment that companies will do badly because they will be forced by governments to make a transition towards sustainability, the perception is that transition risks have gone down. But what we see on the other side is that the physical risks, the way that climate impacts storms and floods, but also longer term things like droughts and sea level rise, they are getting bigger and bigger year on year. And the latest scientific evidence is it's happening much faster and much more intensely than any of the climate models predicted. And with nature loss, we're reaching tipping points. We're reaching tipping points where forests will not be able to generate the water that is needed for agriculture in many parts of the world because of the very high level of deforestation. The very intensive agriculture, use of pesticides and fertilizers is leading to sterility in soil and falling agricultural yields in many parts of the world. So those direct physical impacts start to affect financial market expectations as well. And that's why if you're an insurance company or a pension fund, you might start thinking, hang on a sec, I think I would like to have some nature positive assets in my portfolio in order to protect all of the economic activities that depend on nature, which are reflected in my other assets.
And what about the financial incentive of the buyers? You mentioned pension funds earlier, Estelle. Those pension funds need to make money. So will they make money off this, or should we expect that the buyers might more be, say, carbon and nature destroyers who want to, you know, get right with their consciences and with investors' concerns about the sort of brownfields development Heather was talking about?
Well, I guess two things. I mean, first, I think Heather already mentioned that, I mean, these funds tend to be much more long-term oriented, right? So they tend to be themselves, they're already doing some of their readjustments. But it is true that in our proposal, still, despite this, we think we need to put a mandate on these pension funds. So it's an obligation. So it's not that they're making, because if they were making money out of this, we would not need to put a mandate, right? It's just to say like all of these pension funds would need to be Paris aligned, knowing that two things, some are already doing this, right? That's Heather's point. And two, the work that Patrick Bonton and his co-authors have done has shown that there's a very small penalty to be Paris aligned. Okay, very small in terms of returns. Okay. And our solution would actually bring a an option to make a possibility to make it even cheaper or to reduce even further the penalty to be Paris aligned or, you know, Montreal aligned when it happens. So that's, so, you know, just to be sure, it's not, you know, you shouldn't go into that business to make money. You should do this because it is generating these, you know, external benefits that are important, and it does it in a way that doesn't cost a lot for these pension funds in terms of lower returns.
Because there's a difference between making money and saving money. So this is about risk management, because you can still make money investing in oil and gas companies, no question about it. But if you hold those assets, you are increasing the risks of losing the value of all kinds of other assets, some of which are essential for human life. So that's where, if you think about it as a risk management thing, where you want to balance your portfolio and you want to make sure that there's some nature positive things going on in order to sustain all of the economic activities that depend on them. But the other thing is, governments have to be involved here, because ultimately this is a public good. Financial markets are not going to take care of this problem on their own. No way. Because making money is so much more important in financial markets than saving money. Saving money for future generations is the job of governments. And so that's where public money needs to be invested in both nature conservation and restoration, both to ensure that the whole of society can benefit from nature, because we all depend on it. Every human being depends on it. But also so that future generations will still have nature there in order to sustain life and economic activity. And I think this role of governments is very important, because there seems to be an assumption in a lot of the debate about nature credits and even nature shares that, oh, well, that's great. That means the private sector is going to unlock loads and loads of finance. That means we can just slash government budgets related to biodiversity because we don't need that government money anymore. No, absolutely not true. The amount of extra money that could be raised through nature credits and shares, hard to calculate. It depends a lot on the mandates that Estelle was just talking about. It could be a lot bigger than the 1 million in transactions that's currently the case, but there's no way it's going to get anywhere near the actual needs. And also, it's not going to be incentivized in that way. So you still need government budgets to both protect and to ensure that, for example, public land is managed in a way that defends nature, but also to ensure that private landowners still live up to their responsibilities to society in maintaining nature.
Thanks. I appreciate your explaining that public role, because when we talk about risk management and how the pension companies are mitigating risk, it's not their specific risk on their specific balance sheet. And efforts to directly correlate that risk to specific corporate balance sheets still have a long way to go. Whereas if you say it's a public good and the government has to do this at a societal level, government makes people pay a lot of things for a lot of public goods in different ways, and that makes some sense. What about then the question of jurisdictional transfer? It's one thing to tell a local pension fund that they need to buy into efforts to preserve a park where their pensioners live, but getting that money out of their jurisdiction into the Global South, Estelle, how hard a sell is that?
And also that's why I think it's how you organize the funding of nature restoration and conservation depends on, you know, what you do. Because, you know, I think there's a lot of initiatives at the EU level to do it within Europe. Here, given that we were given this challenge to figure out how to scale up finance to the Global South, we had to, you know, this was kind of a part of our homework. So how do we do this? We need to go from a largely privately governed market as it is today to a publicly governed, so basically public governance of these markets. It's the organization of the primary market, but it's also all of the monitoring and verification needs to be in the public hands. And that could be done at the, you know, something like at the UN level or at least a multilateral kind of organization to do that. It would be, you know, able to do this and would have the legitimacy then so that the insurance companies or the funds would actually trust the mechanism.
So that explains how you get the mechanism to work. But what about just the hesitation to send money abroad that doesn't bring an immediate financial return?
Well, you do. I mean, so first, it's not about financial returns. Remember, these dividends are physical dividends. They're carbon or they're measured in terms of biodiversity metric. So you do have a backing of a multilateral governmental organization behind this. So, you know, I'm just, there's many of those where, you know, multinationals and private corporations, you know, interact with these public bodies and they trust them. So we need to, of course, make sure that there's trust in these institutions. But, you know, it could be sponsored by the World Bank, could be sponsored if it is at the EU level, you know, the international arm of the European Investment Bank. And you can think about different ways to do this to make sure that the investors trust the mechanism.
It's key to remember that the benefits that nature provides are not only local. A forest in West Africa provides the moisture flow, the rivers in the sky that work in terms of atmospheric physics, that bring water to the watershed that feeds the Nile River. So if you don't want the hundreds of millions of people who live and along the Nile and depend on the water there to be short of water and therefore unable to grow crops, to produce all kinds of products that are sold to Europe, for example, or indeed to move to Europe because of the pressure created by falling water flow, then it's in the direct self-interest of Europeans to ensure that deforestation in West Africa stops. So I think we have to remember that the planet is a living organism with very strong interdependence between different regions. We tend to think of it as, I'm willing to fund my local park because I like to see the animals in my local park. But actually, the water, the air, the stable climate, the temperature that we are experiencing in one part of the planet depends very much on nature, which is there in other parts of the planet. And we see those. Many of the forests, the Amazon most notably, is reaching a tipping point where the Amazon is quite close to turning into a savanna and into a net emitter of greenhouse gases rather than a net absorber of greenhouse gases. That will have an impact on ocean currents as well as on moisture flows across large parts of the planet. So that's where the whole idea of nature credits should not just be. It's very nice to have local charities which sell credits locally for local services. That's great. But you also need to think about the planetary systems which depend on biology and physics and chemistry, which financial markets largely ignore.
We're talking a lot about the developing world, and we've seen people who work on the ground in those communities complaining that high-minded global efforts often are too much paperwork and too little substance. So a small batch agricultural producer is somehow seen as less sustainable than a larger, more agribusiness type outfit because the agribusiness person can jump through the hoops and the small batch person, first of all, can't fill all the compliance forms out and may also need to have one disqualifying thing, like, you know, a gas generator, or I'm making this up, but some sort of thing that is out of compliance, even when overall they're very small and local and nature preserving. So how do you account for those sorts of on the ground realities?
I mean, I think these are important points. So the first, I mean, you're making the point about small guys, small projects versus large projects. The small projects, sometimes it's just the cost of doing all of this paperwork is too much. And that's why we are actually proposing to do it at the jurisdiction level. So hopefully this is addressing that part. The other part is that there are, you know, it's not black and white. There are some good projects, but they have that one feature that doesn't quite meet the high standard that certifier may have set. And so here, that's also important that just to take into account all of the multi-dimensions, all the dimensions of these projects, to account for them in a more holistic manner and in more continuous manner, okay? So let me just be a bit more precise. It's not zero or it's not black and white. Okay, today, we've raised the standards for these certificates, for these credits, and it means that there's a fewer that can actually meet all of the criteria. It means the market is becoming smaller. If you want to expand the market, you may need to be more flexible. But more flexible doesn't mean getting all of them on the same basis. It means that there's going to be less money if you don't have, you know, quite all of the quality of your product is lower, right? But at least there's a gradation of these things. And you need to figure out how to put this in the price.
And then you're doing it at the jurisdictional level. So presumably you need a local public authority of some such. Is the idea that that would charge a lower rent than the current 40% taking intermediaries? You referred to early on.
So in principle, at least some of the fixed costs would be spread over a bigger surface.
In the last part of our podcast, we're going to talk about what's next. Heather, where's the EU on this? We're at the start of a new budget cycle. We're having an intense self-reflection period of what are our goals? What are our public goods? How does this fit in there?
Well, the EU has launched a new way of thinking about nature credits. The Commission put forward a roadmap towards nature credits last July, and they've now formed an expert group, which Bruegel is also part of, to think about how to put them together, to make sure that these are high integrity markets, which avoid many of the pitfalls seen in with carbon credits. You know, these have got to be really, on the supply side, really trustworthy financial instruments. I think they will also look at the demand side a bit further on, but there's a lot to think about there. Now, the question is, in the EU context, what could nature credits be for? Well, one thing is simply to bring in additional finance from whatever sources. And you're always going to need on the supply side much better monitoring, reporting, verification, making sure that the credits are providing additional finance, that they are providing durable projects, which won't, you know, the forest that you're supporting doesn't get burned down, or if it does, that there's an adequate provisioning and so on. All of that's good work. The question is, what else will happen in the EU around this? Because if the EU spends a lot of time and energy getting together a really beautiful regulatory framework for nature credits, which makes sure they're super high integrity, but then there's hardly anybody buying them, then that's rather a waste of time. So they need to be looking at the demand side. But also, if they don't eliminate any of the harmful subsidies that are already there in the EU budget under the Common Agricultural Policy and others, then it's really quite pointless. It's a very interesting study on harmful subsidies under the previous EU budget, which came to a figure of about 48 billion euros annually. And our colleagues here at Bruegel, Jolt Darvas notably, has done a very interesting look at green mainstreaming EU in the EU budget and found not very impressive results in terms of the greening of the EU budget. So as we move into a new cycle, there's both the issue of will the funding for biodiversity that's there in the LIFE program and other parts of the budget, will that be diminished? With nature credits being used as an excuse to diminish it by saying, oh, well, you know, private sector will provide this money now, when we know that this is really quite unlikely to reach the right kind of scale. And the other risk is that nature credits are brought in as a nature positive thing, but without eliminating any of the harmful subsidies, which go directly to economic activity through an extremely well organized and administratively already established system. So it's unlikely that they'd be able to counteract them. So I think that's where the EU really needs to start. Yes, work on nature credits, it's all really good, but also address the subsidies.
Estelle, do you see your work getting picked up by policymakers?
I think Heather will know better than me on this one. But, you know, it's important that, you know, we actually drafted this as part of the Paris report to prepare for COP30. And, you know, the key thing about when you're drafting such proposal is to plant the seeds for these ideas. And of course, every conversation is one step further, because it's every conversation is an opportunity when you hear concerns, you hear pluses and minuses, and you can refine your projects. I think for our proposal can serve as an input to what could happen in Europe, but for sure needs to be amended, and because you need to adapt it to the local context. And to the, among others, I think Heather made the point that, you know, there are benefits that are, nature is providing benefits that some of this is local and some of this is are a global regional. In Europe, there's much more of these benefits are actually local from the, you know, the, where the funders are and where these projects are, unlike in our proposal where you've got global south versus global north. So I think because of this, it means that in terms of how you design the funding, how you think about the demand side would be different for this reason.
The Paris Report, for listeners who don't know, is a joint annual project by Bruegel and the Center for Economic Policy Research. It's like a book of different related articles. Last year, we had Paris Report 3. It had chapters in it by Estelle and co-authors and by Heather and co-authors talking about different elements of this. And it's available for free on our website, Bruegel.org. As we come close to the end of our time, I'd sure love to hear from each of you what you would most like listeners to come away with from this and what you would like people to keep in mind going forward?
The main thing is that trashing nature is going to be very, very expensive for us. Already, it's starting to cost as we see agricultural yields declining and as water stress becomes a reality for people in many parts of the world, including Europe, as we see floods and droughts and so on. These are expensive. They also have a toll on human lives, and they make it more difficult to do the kinds of economic activities that people want to pursue. So the increasing cost of losing more and more nature is something that's got to be factored into economics at every level. Here in Europe, we have nature is in a really poor state. There's an alarming decline. About 80% of EU habitats are in poor condition. 70% of soils are unhealthy. We have severely eroded croplands. 40% of bird species have a poor or bad conservation status. These are all official figures from the European Environmental Agency. And that's because we've had several centuries of industrialization in which we have trashed our nature. So we don't have the enormous forests that the world needs in order to maintain, to keep carbon out of the atmosphere and generate hydrological cycles and provide all these other benefits. So it really makes sense for Europeans both to look after their own nature much better and to restore, under the Nature Restoration Law, for example, a lot of these eroded habitats and get back the pollinators and the biodiversity that used to be here. We could actually go quite far. We could do that quite quickly. And here in Europe, there is money. There's money from national governments and from the EU that could be used better in that respect. And nature credits could add to that. But there's also, it really, really makes sense to fund in the global south where there is the greatest biodiversity, the biodiversity that we depend on for new medicines, for example, the biodiversity that we depend on for maintaining also the climatic conditions that matter for Europe, which is a continent warming at twice the global rate. So I think from that point of view, we have to not consider it as either or. Either we fund in Europe or we fund elsewhere in the world. It's got to be both and.
Yeah, and I second that. And maybe, you know, what I'd like the listeners to come out with is just think about, remember that nature is a capital. It's this economic capital, this natural capital. And so we need to view it really as capital, as equity rather than a transaction. And we need to think about robust mechanism to reward the conservation and the restoration of nature. And that's really something we haven't quite figured out so far.
Thanks so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I've been joined today by my colleague, Heather Graby, and by Professor Estelle Cantillon. You can read some of the papers we've been talking about in the show notes and find our research and our past episodes on our website, bruegel.org, and all your favorite podcast channels. Thanks for listening. See you next time.